So, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah. I am Dan Kalb, candidate for Oakland City Council in District 1.
Perfect. Can you tell me about the moment you decided to run?
Oh, it was really, it wasn't a moment. It was a whole process. When I knew that this seat was becoming vacant, I spent several months last year just talking to community leaders, neighborhood leaders, some elected officials, and most importantly, my wife, about, you know, what do they think about me running, and, you know, who else might run, and what do I think. I want to explain to people what I thought I might be able to accomplish, what my goals are, my background. And I got a lot of encouragement. So I finally sat down in December of last year with my wife, and we talked about, you know, how much energy it's going to take and time, but we both decided it was the right thing to do. And you know, I've never been a spectator. I've always been somebody who gets involved in things and tries to make a difference. And so this seemed like a logical next step in my career to go from the outside. I've been a policy advocate, a public interest organizer, environmental advocate, policy director. I've always been kind of on the outside looking in, facing in, working with elected officials in a number of capacities. And now it's my time, I think, to cross the line and become the actual public official, the actual elected policymaker who could accomplish big things. So it was it wasn't a hard decision to make, but it was a lengthy process to come to that conclusion.
Has campaigning been like what you expected it to be, or has it been different?
Oh, no, it's more or less what I expected. You know, I've been involved in political campaigns in the past. I know what it means to be to run for office and to engage in campaigns and to talk to voters on a one-on-one basis. And I knew it was going to be a tremendous job to do this and a tremendous amount of work and essentially impossible to do everything you want to do. But you just prioritize and do as much as you can do and talk to as many voters as you can. And that's what I've been doing so far. And, you know, it's great.
Oh, no problem. Hey, takes a toll on the body, huh?
That's just allergies.
Yeah. Oh. What do you think of the field so far?
Well, it's a crowded race, but everybody expected that. There are 7 candidates running. These are all, you know, good, decent people who care about the community we live in, care about the city, and care about the people in the city. So I have nothing, you know, bad per se about any of the candidates. There are some similarities and there are differences, as you would expect. Nobody agrees on everything all the time. There's differences maybe in more emphasis, what one's priorities might be. We may feel as similar about a certain issue, but who's going to take the lead on this and who's going to take the lead on that? And, you know, there's some differences maybe are more pronounced among some candidates, but you know, they're good people, and I think the residents of District 1 will be served well no matter who wins, but I think they'll be served most well if I win. I think it's – many people have said it's coming down between me and one other candidate who's the only woman in the race, and I think they're probably right based on the information I've – heard from people, that kind of the buzz out there, the amount of support in terms of, you know, signs and money and people. And, you know, again, anything could happen with ranked choice voting, and I support ranked choice voting. But, it almost is like our campaign is not about reacting or being tactical because of what somebody else is doing in their campaign. I think other campaigns are doing it that way because I've noticed things. But you know, we're just running our – I'm running my campaign with my staff and my consultant and my tremendous number of volunteers. And, you know, we're not changing our tactics or our strategy because somebody else who's running does something this or something that or because they are this or they are that. You know, we're running our campaign and we're running a good campaign, and so I'm very confident we'll succeed.
I'm interested in the consultant. How did you choose this firm over the others available?
There really was no choice in the matter. Doug Linney is an old friend and someone I've known for over 20 years, and he has some strong ties to the environmental community, and there was no even question in the race. He was like, okay, oh yeah, I'm going to run for race. Oh, of course, I hired Doug. And he said, oh, of course, I'm going to, you know, take Dan on as a client. And so, you know, he's a very experienced consultant here in the East Bay. He's run local races before and successfully. But most of all, I chose him because I trust him and that he runs positive campaigns. And I run positive. I want to be running a positive campaign, and I'm not going to, you know, go negative or anything like that. And so it was a very logical decision to make, and I'm glad I made that decision.
So, in your conversations about strategy, what has emerged about the way to win in District 1? And maybe sort of in answering that question, if you could talk about the characteristics, the voter profile of a District 1 voter.
District 1 is a very large district. It goes all the way from what we call the North Hills, the very northern parts of Montclair and Hiller Highlands and such, down through Upper Rock Ridge, Lower Rock Ridge, Temescal, Piedmont Avenue area, and then it goes into the neighborhoods west of MLK, the Longfellow, Golden Gate, Santa Fe neighborhoods, and that to the Emeryville border, and you know, north to the Berkeley border, and south to, you know, MacArthur or the overpass, and so on. And so it's a very large district, and it's some people have a limited stereotype of the district. Oh, you're District 1, that's upscale. And well, some parts of it are, but a large portion of the district is really much more mixed. And really, those portions of the district, what I would call the western half of the district, if you will, really have become the stepchildren, those neighborhoods become the stepchildren of the city. They're not getting the same attention as they deserve and as they need. And so, when I'm elected, I'm going to make sure that those neighborhoods get more attention because they need more attention. Every neighborhood has crime, and that can't be discounted. But the neighborhoods west of MLK have more crime and more serious crime than the rest of District 1. The neighborhoods west of MLK have a much more of a economically diverse population and racially diverse population, and are much more in desperate need of more economic activity and economic development and kind of economic stimulus. And so I'm gonna be aware of that every day I'm in office, and not ignore any neighborhood in my district. I'm not going to ignore the entire city, but I'm going to put a little extra emphasis on those parts of the district that need it the most. And that could help the whole city. For example, if we revitalize the San Pablo corridor in Northwest Oakland, which is in desperate need of revitalization, and the people there want it, and I've been talking about it for months, not just when I'm in those neighborhoods, but I'm talking about it even when I'm up in the hills and Upper Rock Ridge, wherever. If we're successful, that brings more economic activity and more tax revenue into the city for the entire city. And so that's a high priority for me, and I'm gonna make it a big deal. I'm gonna make sure it happens. So it's hard to peg. You can't just peg this district is this, or this district is that, or District 1 is this or that. It's really a mixed district, and that's one of the joys of living in Oakland is the diversity and the mix of people who live so close to each other. So I'm going to pay attention to everybody and work hard to represent the district well.
So I'd love to kind of use what you said about the San Pablo corridor as a jumping off point to talk about specific policy solutions. You know, obviously there are intangibles in terms of communication and, you know, good feelings. But, you know, in terms of specific policy, you know, how do you revitalize the San Pablo corridor?
Well, a combination of things need to happen. One, we have to be hard-nosed on the late-night prostitution that happens in that area. And the people who, quote-unquote, manage those prostitutes need to be put away. They are... Yeah, I have no tolerance for them. The prostitutes themselves, in most cases, just need some new direction. And I don't want to, you know, demonize them in a big way, but we need to get them off the streets and into something more productive. And the people who are profiting from those people need to be put away, at least for a period of time. So that's one thing, is clean up the late night prostitution and to some extent the drug dealing, to the extent that still happens in that neighborhood, which it does to some extent. But it's really kind of beautifying the neighborhood. Literally beautifying the neighborhood, whether it's planting more trees, making sure there are continual cleanups. I mean, compare it to, like, you know, College Avenue, you know, the businesses on College Avenue would not stand for dirt and a bunch of kind of messy streets and graffiti. Well, okay, the people of San Pablo Avenue and their businesses there have a right to that same level of cleanliness and beautification. And that attracts businesses. So I want to kind of beautify that neighborhood, the San Pablo corridor and nearby streets, and then really create this, you know, marketing campaign, talk to the landowners, business owners, those who are leasing the land or own the land, and, you know, try to attract more businesses, small businesses, support some selective mixed-use housing developments right on San Pablo, because then they have retail on the ground floor and a couple stories of housing above that. And that's a logical place to do that. And so, you know, let's just have more economic activity. You know, as the economy starts to grow a little bit, business people will be looking for places to open up their businesses. And there are some good businesses already there on along San Pablo. And let's just add to that. You know, Emeryville doesn't need everything. We deserve it as well. So I'm going to be a strong advocate and a marketer for Northwest Oakland and the San Pablo corridor, among other things that I want to accomplish when it comes to economic development. Should I talk more about my economic development?
I'd love to kind of dive more into that. I've been on San Pablo and I see how it's a little, there's not much there. But so if you take something like, you know, arresting the pimps or keeping the pimps off the street, do you have a sense of why that isn't happening now and what you as a council member could do? I guess I'm trying to get at this potential gap between, you know, what everyone wants and what does it actually take to make that happen?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, there's no easy answer, because if the easy things are already being done or have been done, or anybody could do them, so you don't need me to do the easy things. It's going to take. It gets into the question of the level of police officers we have right now. We have 631 police officers. We need well over 800 to really come close to functioning as a city that gets enough coverage among the police and different shifts and so on. And it takes having a presence, you know, patrolling, having a presence, making it a situation where they're not going to be able, you know, they're not going to be able to get any. They go where there's demand and where they can get business, as any business person would. So if the police are patrolling and discouraging just by their presence, they're not going to get any business there. They're going to stop. They're not going to go there. Now, they may go somewhere else, you know, and that's not necessarily a good thing. So ideally, you want to be able to arrest some of the people who are behind this. And if to the extent that they could find out who those people are, and sometimes they can, sometimes they can't, we should set some examples, and let people know that we don't have a tolerance for this kind of stuff. Especially since in some cases these are underage prostitutes. Those people who are using these underage prostitutes need to be put away for serious time. You know, it's bad enough you have adult prostitution that in a neighborhood that doesn't want it, clearly, but the underage prostitutes is just a whole new level of crime that should not be tolerated. And I think there's an effort through the city and county to really try to figure out ways to be more present and discourage that and monitor that. And I want to be part of that. You know, and the city council needs to put money in the budget to you know, create programs to transition prostitutes to a different world of work, then we should be supporting those efforts. If there are state laws we need to enforce more strongly, then we should be doing that. So I don't have an easy answer. I'm just saying, if you're determined, you can make some progress. Plus, when you start cleaning up the neighborhood and inviting more businesses there, it becomes a less attractive place to do that. Prostitutes generally, I'm not an expert in this area, of course, but I think they generally tend towards the more run-down neighborhoods. I don't know that for sure, but I believe so. And so I would think that let's make this no longer run-down neighborhood, and therefore they won't really be welcome here any longer. So that's one area. And then I definitely want to really, you know, like I said, really market San Pablo as a place that has enough density of population to show the demand for small businesses, and including retail businesses or even office, you know, offices, small offices, and so on. I think it can be. I met the people in the neighborhood. I've been going to meetings in that neighborhood for a year now or more, and I went to one meeting in that neighborhood with the local Golden Gate neighborhood. It's called the Neighborhood Crime Prevention Council, NCPC for short. And I went there earlier in the year, and I've gone to almost every month since. when I first went to her, some of them said, wow, nobody comes to visit us. You know, I mean, no one like in City Hall comes to visit us, or rarely. The police come because they're required to once every month. But and I kept on going on a regular basis to learn from them as to what are the crime problems that they have. You know, I learned more about some of the drug houses that they have in that neighborhood still, and the burglaries and the types of crimes that are more prevalent in those neighborhoods, in that neighborhood. So that was educational for me, which was part of my whole kind of listening strategy. I go door to door or go to community meetings and talk to voters and tell them about my background, what do I want to accomplish, and why I think I'll be a strong city council member. But then I also spend a lot of time listening to what they have to say, you know, expressing their concern or asking a couple of questions. If a council member is not listening and learning, then they're not really going to be an effective council member. And so I think you have to listen almost as much as you have to talk and do. So
I can talk about more economic development.
Let's talk more. Maybe if you want to talk about clean tech.
Yeah. Well, I spent the last 9 years working as the policy director for the Union of Concerned Scientists here in California. And I've had really over a decade of experience working on clean tech issues, working closely with clean tech business leaders and other stakeholders involved in the whole clean energy and clean technology industries. And you know, many of those business leaders around the state in the Bay Area know me and trust me, and some of them are supporting my campaign, of course. And so I want to bring more clean technology businesses, or grow the ones we have here already, as a way of stimulating the local economy and providing more jobs for Oakland residents. It's interesting that during the recent recession, a very serious recession, that the one area of the state's economy that actually grew was the clean tech sector, the green job sector. And so we could build upon that. And Oakland is a logical place to do that. And no one's against it. You know, no one in City Hall that I know of is against it. Nobody in City Hall is saying, I want to invite some polluting technologies to Oakland. No one's that. But no one's really taking leadership to make it happen. You know, we just approved something at the Oakland Army Base, a new project there to expand the port operations and so on. And, you know, that's fine. That's okay. But I would have set aside at least some of that land to invite some clean tech light manufacturing. It's a logical place to do that. Oakland is a logical place to have more clean tech businesses, whether it's light manufacturing or office space or whatever. We're less expensive to lease land than Silicon Valley or than San Francisco. We got Oakland Airport right next door here. We have NGOs based here in Oakland that work on the whole notion of green jobs and have been for years. They're based here in Oakland. We have the East Bay Green Jobs Corridor that's based in Oakland that really is working to promote more green jobs. We have unions and apprenticeship programs that are really interested in promoting more clean technology and green jobs. And so we have existing businesses already. We have some solar companies, energy efficiency firms, Bright Source Energy, Sungevity, other solar companies, some energy efficiency firms. We could also be a place where companies come to manufacture pollution control technology. We have an energy and climate action plan, a landmark plan. It's on the books in Oakland. We have, I think, one person who's working on implementing it in the Department of Public Works. He's a good guy. He's doing a good job. But I don't think that plan and the policies in that plan, some of which create lots of jobs, are really a high enough priority for the city. I'm going to make it a high priority. I want to do things that are good for the environment, both short-term and local, and long-term and you know, broader than local, the Bay Area-wide, even you know, planetary-wide, obviously, and things that will stimulate economic activity, provide public health benefits, and create jobs. And so we can do those things. We could find out what those things we really know what some of those things are. We could find out what those are and really be a nationally recognized clean tech hub. And I really feel committed to that. I think big. You know, it takes a step at a time to get to where you're going. And I realize that. I know policy making. I know things don't go that quickly sometimes. But if you're determined, like I am, and you set a goal, and you can know how to work with other people, then we can make Oakland a nationally recognized clean tech hub. And I'm going to work hard to make that happen. And I know other council members, or at least other people who are running for council in other districts, like those ideas, and I could be a leader in that area because I understand those policy. For example, electricity policy. It's one of the most complicated, intricate areas of public policy in the entire state, clean energy, electricity. I've worked on that issue for over a decade. I've worked with the folks at the PUC, legislators, experts, engineers, academics. I understand the issues and they know I understand those issues. So if I go out there and say, listen, I want to bring more solar company, they're going to say, oh, well, Dan knows what he's talking about. Okay, let's listen to what I have to say. So that's going to be one of my top priorities as part of an economic development strategy, put an emphasis on clean technology jobs and industries.
Yeah, that's a great vision. I'd love to see that. I think that's. But I'm interested to hear more about how your main job is kind of writing policy. I guess you can be kind of a cheerleader for the city, but as someone, you know, what policies encourage people to come here?
Well, it's a range of things, and you have to. I don't want to discount what those range of things are. There are some incentives, temporary incentives we could provide. We have some things on our website, the city's website already, that are what I would call passively inviting green businesses and clean technology businesses to come to Oakland. That's not enough. You have to have a planned, determined strategy and marketing campaign to bring those businesses here, and somebody has to head that up. And if the mayor is busy with other very important things, I'm willing to take the lead on heading that up. And that means bringing together the Chamber of Commerce, some of the CEOs or presidents of some of the existing clean tech companies that are here, and talking with clean tech business leaders around the state who we determine might have an interest in moving or locating, or if there are potential new business having a startup here. We already are to some extent kind of an incubator for kind of clean tech startups. In fact, Sungevity provides space, office space for some of these clean tech incubators already, these new companies that could grow. And there's room, whether it's part of the Army base or Jack London Square, or even maybe a warehouse in San Pablo or on Lowell Street in Northwest Oakland or other parts of the city. I mean, if you put this kind of business in a certain part of the city, you're helping the entire city. You're providing jobs for Oakland residents. You're providing tax revenue that goes into the city's budget that we desperately need. So, I'd love to get some of that in District 1, but that's really a citywide goal, is make the entire city a clean tech hub. And so I'm going to be the person who's going to be available and offer and want to lead that marketing effort, that marketing campaign, and to find out, based on discussing things with clean tech trade associations and business leaders, what they need to what criteria they use to decide where to go, and if they don't want to be in California, then why? I'm not even going to bother talking to them. But California has policies that I've helped enact in some cases that make California a leader for a lot of the clean tech businesses, or probably an opportunity to be a leader. And so a lot of these companies logically want to be based in California and in the Bay Area. Well, if they want to be in Northern California, they should come to Oakland. We have a lot to offer. We have the best weather in the entire planet, maybe, I would say. We have great people who love living in Oakland. Wonderful restaurants. We're considered one of the top cities in the country for a place to go, believe it or not. And yeah, we have our problems, and we're looking to address those problems. Every city has problems, and we're going to be a great partner and a great neighbor and a great host for any clean tech business that really wants to locate here.
What about subsidies, tax abatements, those kind of?
Yes, on a temporary basis, I'm open to that. I'm not interested in giving permanent subsidies or tax or waivers, fee waivers. I call them fee waivers. I'm not interested in giving permanent fee waivers to anybody. But if a temporary waiver is all it takes, for 2.5 years or something to get somebody, or a partial waiver, let's say, to get a company that is going to provide lots of jobs for Oakland residents, hey. That's a win-win, I think. So again, you got to look at things on a case-by-case basis. I'm not going to provide windfalls to some, well-to-do corporations, that they don't really need. But if tipping the balance, if a temporary fee waiver for a couple of years tips the balance to get them here, I'm open to that.
I've looked at your platform, and one issue I don't see on there is long-term structural debt, financial issues. I'm wondering if you see that as a problem.
Anybody who doesn't see that as a problem doesn't know what they're talking about and should be running for office. Yes, I do see that as a serious problem. I think everybody does. And I haven't heard anybody yet who has any magic answer or answers as to what to do. Or I should say, as to what to do that would completely solve the problem. You know, I have ideas, and I try to put together a handful of things that I've been talking about when folks ask me about this, as to what are some of the things that we can do to move more towards addressing some of those long-term problems, long-term financial challenges that we have to meet our obligations, our past obligations. And those obligations are upwards of over $2 billion, really. That has to do with an old pension system that's no longer in existence, but you're still paying people who are retired. And then the city's contributions to the existing pension system, which is CalPERS, the state pension system, and then some healthcare costs for retirees who used to work for the city. And those total are over $2 billion over time, not in 1 year, but over time. And that could get even more. I mean, if you start paying those off with bonds that you're floating, then you're going to be paying interest on the bonds, and so you end up incurring even more debt. You're kind of kicking the can down the road. And I could understand the motivation for bonds when you have a down economy and you already cut to the bone. You already have 600, only you only have 631 police officers, and when you want over 800, you've already cut back hours at libraries and senior centers, and you've cut back almost every department and furloughed workers a couple times a month, whatever. You've done everything you could do, and you've gotten some give backs from some of the public employees, and still. So I could see why that there's no tolerance really for trying to cut back more in the short term, you know, current fiscal year. And so, okay, so then they think, well, I guess we've got to float a bond for the time being until the economy picks back up, and then we have more options. So I can understand that. I'm not thrilled by it, but I understand when you have those difficult choices. There are no good choices here. There's only choices and a combination of choices. As we increase our economic activity, some of that money needs to go into an infrastructure fund, and some of it needs to go into a pay off your retirement debts fund. I'll think of some catchy name about it. But you know, some of it needs to go be earmarked for paying off some of this long term debt. Or some people call it a structural debt or past pension-related obligations. And if it doesn't get earmarked for that, then it just gets floated away into everything else that we need in the more immediate term. And that's not going to help anybody in the long term, because eventually the chickens come home to roost, as they say. And then what? You know, then do you go bankrupt? That's not an option as far as I'm concerned. It's not an option I want to pursue. You have to start paying it off. And so economic activity, again, these short-term bonds are stopgap measures that really cannot solve the problem overall. They can't solve the problem overall. And then you have to decide, do we ask the voters, not now, but you know, a few years down the road, to pay for additional money, additional assessments or additional taxes or fees to pay directly for immediate services like more police or for other services that people strongly support, so that then there frees up some money in the general fund budget to contribute over to these longer term obligations. And some of the public employees are going to be asked to negotiate. Through negotiations, we're going to ask them to be part of this solution as well, as they have in the past. The SEIU, the largest public employees union, took a loss last year and gave back some what they had previously been promised, and that can't be overlooked. People have already given back, and most employees who work for the city, who are a member of this largest union, SEIU, are not rich, well-to-do people, are not making tons of overtime, are not being paid, you know, $100,000 or that. You always hear these examples. Here's some public employee getting paid all this money. That's the exception, not the rule. And so most of them are just making a middle-class wage and struggling. And luckily, they have a health care plan, and that's pretty good, and a retirement system. But they're not rich. Trust me, they are not rich. And police and fire can't be exempt from consideration and from asking to make some tough decisions through negotiations. And I support those efforts. I mean, we have to do a multitude of things to get to where we need to get to. And even then, it's going to be challenging. And so let's try a little bit of all the things. And hopefully that will add up to a few big steps in paying down this debt over time. And then, you know, a few years later, we'll evaluate the situation and take more steps. A few years later, we'll evaluate the situation and again, take more steps. It's not going to all happen overnight. So, but I'm committed, you know, as a city council, we're in charge of the city budget, you know, the biannual budget, and we have a responsibility to not ignore this problem and kick it down the road too far. So I'm going to, you know, swallow the hard pill and face it head on. It's not going to be pleasant.
I don't have much more time because I've got a parking that's about to expire.
Do you want to go put something in the meter for me?
Well, I think I got a little bit of time just to ask if there's anything else you'd like to add.
Sure, there are a couple more things I'd like to chat about. One is crime prevention. That's really the thing I've been talking about. That and the green tech is the stuff I've been talking about the most equally. We clearly need more police and more crime investigators. And that's one thing that others haven't been talking about. But if you're not solving crimes, you're not, you know, if you're not investigating, you're not solving them. If you're not solving crimes, you're not preventing crimes. So we need more crime investigators. But for me, the centerpiece, and this is very, very important, the centerpiece of any comprehensive strategy to reduce crime is to address recidivism. I always ask the question, who commits the most crime? And the people, serious crimes, the people, it's clearly the previous offenders, people who committed crimes before. And so if you're not investing in programs, effective programs that can reduce crime over time, that we can help the people who are coming out of jail, out of prison, who are on probation or on parole, if you're not doing things to move them back into a more productive place in our society, then you're not serious about crime. I don't care how many police you want, and we need more police. I don't care how many you buy or rent or pay for. If you're not investing in recidivism to reduce it, then you are not serious about crime. And I can't stress that enough. If an offender who comes out, whether they're a juvenile offender or adult offender, and they don't have a high school diploma, if you get them a high school diploma, I mean, you have to earn it. They have to go to school and get a high school diploma, the recidivism rate goes down. If you get them job training through an apprenticeship program or some kind of job training that gets them on a pathway to a job, recidivism rate goes down. If you get them drug rehab for those who need that, recidivism rate goes down. I like to say a good education and a pathway to the job are the best deterrents to crime. And it's true. You know, for most offenders, that is absolutely true. And so I want more police. We got to get more police, and we have to pay for that. But we also have to invest seriously in effective programs that reduce recidivism if you're serious about crime. And that's going to be a mantra in my office. It's going to be like my top priority. Over and over again, every week, I'm going to be talking about what are we doing to address recidivism? Who are we talking with at the county? What NGO is working on this? Where can we find funding for that? You know, whether it's federal funding, Measure Y funding, that's a pot of money in the city. You know, I'm going to be focusing on that big time. And if people get tired of me saying it, that's tough. It's going to be a top priority of my office until we help reduce the crime problem substantially. And the last thing I want to talk about is this overarching notion of restoring trust in government. I used to work for Common Cause, the good government organization. So I have a strong, you know, background in, you know, ethics in government and integrity and campaign reform and open, transparent government. And right now, the public, all of us in the public, myself included, really don't have a lot of confidence and trust in City Hall and the City Council. They are sniping at each other in public. They're not getting along, you know, at city council meetings. They're not working together on some issues or many issues. And it just adds more to the sense of lacking confidence. The public just doesn't trust these folks, and they lack the confidence. And if the city council wants to do big things, if we want to do big things, and I do, then the public needs to be behind you. They need to feel at least, they may or may not support the specific idea, but they have to at least feel that, okay, I trust these guys. I have confidence in that they're trying, they're working hard, they're sincere, working together. That's not the way we have it right now. So I want to change that. I want to have a more professional atmosphere and a collaborative atmosphere in City Hall. I have 10 years of mediation experience, so I think that will help. I want to improve and I should say I want to beef up and give more authority to our Public Ethics Commission in the City of Oakland. LA and San Francisco have robust public ethics commissions. We have a facade of one here, and we need to change that. I want to improve customer service in certain city departments. There was a grand jury report that pointed out problems in some city departments. We need to improve that so that people feel that they're being served well, as we all have a right to feel that way. We need a rainy day fund for our budget process, like San Francisco has again. You know, we could learn from other cities around the Bay Area, around the state, in some cases. You know, San Jose has a really good community policing strategy integrated into their whole police force. Oakland doesn't. You know, we have a little bit here and there. So we need to learn from other cities, and as we find more funding, implement things that work, that we know are going to work well. And so I want to be a smart legislator, a collaborative person, but I have strong convictions about what I want to accomplish, and I'm going to work hard to make those things happen.
That's great. You're good at this.
Yeah. So
I can tell you feel it. That's
probably I feel strongly about, like, I'm in this to really, you know, be effective. You know, politics has always been about policy making for me. You know, I've been involved in political campaigns, and I volunteer.